I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. In our sights this week, the deadliest silent assassin, who apparently everyone knows about, John Wick, is thinking he's back. And we talk to the directors of Birds of Passage about their soaring South American drugs epic. Jake Cunningham, and joining my armory of orators this week is Caitlin the Colt Quinlan.
Hello.
And Alistair Bazooka Bayman.
Hello.
And our very own pistol of podcast editing, Mark Towers.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks.
Don't hurt
for,
me with your opinions, because they're so
Jake.
Sharp and powerful. Before we get to rifle through the halls of the Continental Hotel, we'll start with Birds of Passage. It's directed by Ciro Guerra and Cristina Gallego, who previously collaborated on Embrace of the Serpent. Ciro as the solo director and Cristina as the producer on that film. Ali, you actually spoke to the directors about the film, and we'll hear that interview in a little bit. But first, could you just tell us a little bit about this film?
So this is from the filmmakers behind the Oscar-nominated Embrace of the Serpent. It's a tale about indigenous traditions and the corrupting forces of wealth, power, set against the backdrop of a Colombian marijuana boom of the 1970s. A film of both gangsters and spirits, corruption and fratricidal war, this is a thrilling depiction of the origins of the drug trade, told through the story of an indigenous Wayuu's family downfall when greed, passion and honour collide, putting their lives, culture and ancestral traditions at stake.
Lovely. So this is going to be, I think, a brand new film for a lot of people who may not know about the directors or where they've come from. There's not a big boom of South American crime epics going around at the moment, and so maybe if you do see one, this is the one to seek out. But I think people should be really excited about this film. So before we hear from the directors, Caitlin, what do you know about their work so far? Why should people be excited about Birds of Passage?
Yeah, so as Ali said, Embrace the Serpent was their Oscar-nominated kind of predecessor to this. And that is a kind of, I think, you know, it was critically acclaimed, is sort of, you know, has been lauded as this really kind of crazed but wonderful, beautifully shot in black and white. It's this kind of story of the Amazon jungle and tribal kind of tribal warfare, I guess, with the sort of Western influence back in the early 1900s and kind of moving towards the 1930s. So it's such a rich story. I think they make these really elaborately constructed films that have layers upon layers of ideas. Yeah, as I said, beautifully shot. Birds of Passage is no different in that respect. And yeah, it's, you know, kind of carrying on that tradition of just really, really rich storytelling. I think it's definitely one to, but what both of them are ones to watch.
Yeah. And Ciro Guerra is doing his first English language film, which is Waiting for the Barbarians, which is just shot. That's got Johnny Depp, Mark Rylance and Robert Pattinson in. And I think Birds of Passage and Embrace the Serpent has certainly set this kind of world cinema foundation where there's generally a lot of excitement. And although this is not a big blockbuster film, it's got enough people to think of Ciro Guerra as someone to definitely chuck a lot of money at for the
really,
next one.
Really exciting prospect. A really exciting prospect.
So Ali, as we said, you were lucky enough to talk to the directors about quite a number of things.
I was, yeah. Very fortunate. The fact also, I think during the shoot of the film, they divorced. So I was a little bit kind of hesitant going in the interview knowing that. But they were very, very hospitable. Talked about the creative process at length. And yeah, thankfully, no phone interruptions whatsoever.
If there's ever a good reason to get divorced, it's shooting a film together, I think, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder what they would say about it.
Yeah, I'd love to see the Hearts of Darkness doc.
Yeah.
Birds of Passage. All right. So anyway, here we are. This is Chira Guerra and Christina Gallego.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hello, hello. Alistair.
Hi, Chira and Christina. Thank you for joining us on the Cousin Film Podcast.
Thank you.
I was curious to start off because I believe the idea for the film originally came from you, Christina. What was your original thought process in wanting to tell this story?
We came to the area of this of influence of the Bonanza Marimbera. We were doing a film, a film directed by Ciro, that was The Wind Journeys, and was set in the same place and in the same area and in the same years of the Bonanza. And we start to hear about all this history that was the start of the history of the narco traffic, and I think that the first idea was the dream of do a kind of a gangster film like a Godfather in these communities or in a community that has a lot, very straight codes of behavior and all the histories that they tell to us. It makes me imagine a gangster film, because it was a war between families, between clans, and they killed people from each family to the other family with very strong codes of behavior. And it made me think about the films that I have been seeing, and the first idea was to do a film like this. But we know at that moment that we were very immature, that it will be a very big film, and that we will need a big effort from financing or from our cinematography in Colombia. In that moment, it was very, it was starting in the process. But all this history also connect me with the histories that I've been living when I was child in Bogota. And I saw many families grow up and go down, and I live in a middle class neighborhood, and the neighbors and I'm the child of a big family, and I have 9 brothers and sisters, and I saw how the friends of my brothers and sisters and their families became in that business, and at some point start to appear a very richness in the neighborhood, and they start to also disappear to go to the jail. And after 30 years, I have one of my neighborhood that I found him in as a homeless. So I think that it connects with my personal history also, and that is it's a history that I want to tell and to bring out.
You talk about that sense of family. You begin the film with a very vivid opening of the camera kind of spinning around with this traditional Why You Dance. I was wondering, it's kind of a two-handed question, whether that using the traditional Wayuu instruments was an organic thing that sprang up, and also the decision to shoot in colour as opposed to monochrome, which was in Embrace of the Serpent.
Yes, the Wayuu culture is very colourful. It's a culture in which colour has a very profound meaning, and when you see them, you see their handcrafts and the way they dress and the way everything that they do, color plays a big role, and it's very striking, the use of color in the Wayuu culture. So there was no question that this film had to be in color, and in a very vivid color that was true to the way that the Wayuu people represent themselves. So with the costume designer, Catherine Rodriguez did a very profound work of research, going deep into the way that they dress and the way they use their clothes. They have always been a trading community, and they have been forever in contact with the outside world through the sea. So they are always, so they have a very distinctive fashion sense in a way that because they have always been had good access to different textiles from different parts, and the way that they use them to reflect their mythology, their view of the world is very interesting. And we like the idea that this was a film that took elements of the film noir, of the gangster film, which tend to be very dark and very monochromatic. And we went in an opposite direction, and we did a film noir in open air, in open sky, blue sky, desert locations, something more akin to a Western than a noir. And it's a noir in broad daylight, and that's something that... That is interesting for us, because it's a film that is challenging and questioning the elements of genre.
Yeah, you definitely feel that. And how did you go about casting, given that obviously a lot of the cast is I think it's 30% Wayuu or something like that. What was your process with that?
In the crew was 30% Wayuu. 30% of the crew was Wayuu. And in the casting, I think that in the casting we have professional actors. In the family, we have 5 professional actors, but all the rest of the people is Wayuu people, and we work in a mix and in a long workshop together before starting to do the film, a long process of pre-production with them, working together, trying to know from the other what they need, no? The natural actor were preparing themselves with the professional actors, and in the reverse also, no? The professional actors was in the community, was knowing the traditions, was knowing how is to be a Wayuu in what they believe, was knowing the language and their lines in that language. So it was a process of collaboration between all of them, in front of the cameras from the actors and behind the cameras from all of our crew.
You talk about that collaboration. How was it for you working as a director for the first time, and then also Ichiro, your experiences with that as well?
I think that this process was the evolution of a long process together, working together in a creative way. So it was no, the only thing that was different for me was to go to the set, no, and to work with the actors. But we used to have a very near relation and creative relation in our previous films. But I think that the difference was felt more from zero. You can talk about it.
Yes, this was a film that was taking elements of genre and turning them around and trying to propose a new way of looking. The gangster film has usually been very machoistic and about celebration of violence and glorification of criminals, and elements of macho culture have always been very present. But in the Wayuu culture, the women are the ones who are at the center of society, and the ones who are making the big decisions, the ones that are in contact with the spiritual world, and also the ones who handle commerce. So this story needed to have a strong female point of view and a strong female characters. So it made sense for a female director to be part of it, to have a female vision, that to twist the genre around. So yeah, it made sense completely for this project to go on that, or to give a different perspective to a genre that has been that really needs to be questioned and refurbished to give something new.
And I think at the end, the work of collaboration was more to find how our different visions works to create the film, no? And the film, I think, is the result of 2 very different visions and 2 very different, how you say, strength, abilities from each one, and I think in the collaboration we learn to respect the voice of the other and how that voice can be great for the project, and all this I think collision of the words, conflict of the words in terms of tradition to modernity, in terms to intuition, to the reality, in terms to the female world, to the male world. It's the people can see this conflict between those two visions in the film, but the process of collaboration means for us to put these different visions from different sides, you know, from Ciro and for me, and I think that this is the process of collaboration.
You definitely gain that in the sense of the film. I was thinking quite in depth at the way you shoot the film, and it's quite still. Particularly, I'm thinking of that final action sequence. The final act where the fellow gang attack the house. Was that a conscious decision when shooting that, or did kind of external elements make a play in that?
No, it was always a conscious decision from the beginning. Like I said before, this genre has usually been about the celebration of violence and about how, you know, turning these climaxes into big, exciting action sequences with a lot of cuts and a lot of movement. And we wanted to go the absolute opposite way of that, which makes violence cool and makes a celebration of destruction. The big violent climax is happening in a long shot, in a still long shot, and that you can imagine what's going on, and but you can see, but you are powerless. You're looking at it from a distance, and it's unfolding in front of you, but you are powerless. And because that's the way violence feels when when we come from a society that has experienced violence, and there's nothing fun about it, there's nothing cool about it, there's nothing amusing or, you know, so we were offering a completely different perspective on these sequences, on these action sequences, which shouldn't be exciting and shouldn't be cool and vibrant. What you're witnessing is the destruction of people, the destruction of lives, the destruction of culture.
You talk about the gangster genre, but with your kind of focus on this indigenous people, I was seeing a little bit of kind of documentary. Was there any other films apart from a film noir from the 40s, or as you say, The Godfather, that you looked at to take inspiration from?
Yes, there's many sources of inspiration. We like the films of the new Hollywood of the 1970s, the way that they renewed genre and the way that they have a very cinematic perspective on the transformations of society. Particularly for me, The Deer Hunter was a point of inspiration. For Christina, The Godfather was also a big reference. But also, you know, the westerns by John Ford, but we also take inspiration from Latin American cinema. The films of Glauber Rocha for me are a big inspiration. So yeah, we love cinema very much, and we appreciate its history, and we know it, we have studied it. But we're always interested in going to new places. You know, we take from the film, from the history of cinema, a lot of inspiration. But we're not interested in copying. We're always taking stories and genres and forms to new places.
Yeah, you feel that in the film what always stands out for me, think back to it, is the score and the visuals that are unlike something you've ever seen before. But lastly, what's next for both of you? Because I believe, Ciro, you're working, or you've wrapped, I believe, on your English language debut.
Yes, last year we shot our first English language film. It's called Waiting for the Barbarians. It's an adaptation of the novel by South African writer J.M. Coetzee. And Christina is also an executive producer on that film. We have a slate of projects coming up.
Great. I look forward to that. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, thank you to those guys for lending us their time. Let's now move on to Birds of Passage and quickly sum this one up where we can, because there's a lot to sum up. This is very much an epic. I was fortunate enough to see this a while ago. I purposely tried to avoid reviews when I'm going into this, so I kind of knew what it was set, and that was about it. And I'd seen Embrace of the Serpent, and this is even though I didn't know anything, it's not what I expected. This is a true crime epic, a rags to riches tale. It's totally fresh in how it approaches that staple, but also it's familiar as well.
Yeah, definitely. I actually saw Embrace of the Serpent after Birds of Passage, so I kind of went into that film as well, not knowing much. And it opens with this kind of, you know, totally transfixing moment of a young girl's, they call it the coming out ceremony, where she's been sort of kept away for weeks or months, I think, I'm not sure. And she's then sort of brought out into the society, or the sort of tribal society, to meet her potential suitor. And so the film opens on this kind of wonderful scene of totally vivid dancing, basically, and the way that, I think, costume is really important in this film, and the way that clothing is used and fabric and sort of billowing in the wind, you know, across these really stark desert landscapes. It's just, as I say, it's totally transfixing. And
it's like this amazing, like almost like crisp craft paper,
yeah,
like desert,
yeah,
and then you just got this amazing splash of blood red that,
yeah,
just
the colors in
this off.
The contrast, it's totally, yeah, it's amazing, it's so vivid. But yeah, so you start in this world of really rich tradition and kind of alienating tradition, I suppose, and that's kind of the power of this film, I think, is that we start looking in as these outsiders. They call them Alihunas in the film, the people that aren't from their tribe and aren't from, you know, aren't connected to them. And we're watching and we're kind of engaging with this story that we really have no idea how to embrace. But as the film kind of progresses, as Jake says, it becomes a little bit more familiar. We see how corruption and greed start to tear away at these traditions. And yeah, it's kind of heartbreaking in a way to see so much of the kind of destruction of this community from a kind of Western influence, which I think, you know, is where Embrace of the Serpent comes in as well. And it's clearly a kind of passion of the filmmakers to tackle that subject in their work.
I think it's also like a universal story just on the corruption of power. I think regardless, obviously it's set against the kind of backdrop of marijuana, and there's kind of a hint in there of cocaine and a few other substances. But fundamentally, it's just the driving force of this is this one man, Raphael, wants power and wants also to kind of just love this woman, who then the Wayuu tradition comes in and kind of puts a massive kind of,
Spanner in the
I want to say spanner. I was trying to go for something else, but yeah, definitely spanner. But from, as Caitlin was saying, from that kind of vivid initial scene, characters still placed at the forefront, which then, from the moment it starts, you are fully on board with all these people and ready for this visual epic.
And also, like, I think the specific quality of that is kind of like an unhindered capitalism. Because it just like is like a shot, like an injection into this culture that then leads to like pretty much the events that we see in the whole film, and like this kind of tragic downfall. And it wouldn't have been unless there was this kind of
Yeah, like a whole metaphor for kind of colonial power and Western power and influence and just, corruption. Yeah,
yeah, untethered and like it just like is let loose like a wildfire kind of thing.
Yeah, and it almost starts by accident as well. That's what I found. Yeah. I really liked about it.
Yeah,
like when you get to the end of the film and you have the scope of all of the events that have just happened, and you can take it back to this single conversation, which is really satisfying. And they do a great job of having to introduce to us the workings of this world as well, of the way of the value of a dowry and this dance and the symbolism, all of it. And because it just means that as the film goes on, we understand the gravity of the situation, of the betrayal, and how X person betraying X person could influence either on the like the consumer side or on the traditional side. And it does really well to set that up for people that, well, most people that will be watching this film around the world who don't understand how that works.
Yeah, I think that as well, you know, you totally become, as Jake says, you become embedded in these traditions. And one of my favorite characters is the word messenger, who his role in this society is to travel between tribes and communities and sort of be their messenger and be their contact. And, you know, it's such a sacred role, a sacred tradition. And it kind of takes Don't Shoot the Messenger to an entirely new level. But it's wonderful. You become totally, totally engrossed with these habits, and you totally buy into them as well. Like you suddenly understand that, no, this is, you know, there is no greater disrespect or crime than to you know, do anything to betray these people.
Yeah. And for me, that's when the film's at its best. I don't think it's perfect. I think it's when it's showing us these traditions, showing us the word messenger, these quite, to us, fantastical ideas. And it's as the drug trade seeps into the culture, as does the familiar territory of the crime genre. And whilst it is constructed in a formally excellent way, for me, I don't find that as engaging as when it's got that more anthropological lens that it has in the first 20 minutes or so.
Because it's more familiar?
I think so, maybe. Yeah. But obviously for other people, that's going to be a way to get you through to the finish line of it as well, by embracing that.
I've got to say, I really like kind of like the synergy of both, because it felt like this umbilical cord then, like this toxic umbilical cord going to this world like you're talking about, that you have no idea what it's about and you're learning stuff, and there's a joy in learning that. And like this, like the film begins with this this woman being told like she's been in confinement and she has to come out of confinement and to like protect, look for the signs to protect her family, which are usually things we hear said to a male character in maybe the more the Western crime films and crime epics like Godfather, Goodfellas, etc. So I thought that's really interesting that you like take something that is usually like the wise guy being, or the man being made or something like that, and it's taking it in a completely like, because this is, would you agree this is a matriarchy?
Most definitely,
top to bottom. And then, so you start with this and all of the exotic elements that you're not completely familiar with, and then it starts like almost transitioning into this world that we recognise and that we've seen in pop culture cinema.
And that we're kind of complicit in as well.
And that we're, exactly. Yeah. And that's what, I think that's exactly it, that you're getting that complicit, that you realise the complicit nature of the drugs trade and what that's doing, linking those two worlds.
Mm-hmm. I think the familiarity is also interweaved with the strange sounds of the traditional Wayuu instruments. Like just, it's almost like a kind of distorted horn that kind of plays out in moments, particularly when I'm thinking of when the first, I want to call it a betrayal, but between the American pilots, where they have to eventually bury the plane, like this is just overrun by this kind of enormous sound, which in the moment you've seen wise guys kind of cut each other off, but then this, it's almost like an ethereal force kind of lingering above the film, and you don't know what this event will have repercussions for.
That soundtrack really had like Western vibes, because there's Western, the Western genre running through this as well, I feel, and that had this like man with the harmonica kind of thing going on. It's like this eerie sound that, and you feel like a storm's coming.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the point about tradition is that it really does kind of spread its way through this entire film, and you always feel this threat. You're always aware of there are lots of very kind of superstitious characters, and they really believe in you know their visions and their dreams, and there's this constant you know awareness that something else is going on, something's going wrong, which I think for me, even though some of the kind of crime elements feel familiar, that's the part of it that really elevates it for me, and that that kind of makes me really engage with stuff that's maybe I do think it's comparable to The Godfather in a sense, you know, but there is that sort of eeriness that kind of pervades it and runs through it, I just love it. I think it's so rich and great, and the kind of Godfather comparison, I guess, you know, there's this tradition, there's family honor at stake, yeah. You know, and I also think it's a bit long, like it's not really a huge runtime, but it starts to feel a little bit long in the way that I think The Godfather feels a bit long, but there's something kind of layered and deep about that, and the family connection is necessary for.
Well, and going back to your point, Mark, about this being a film with a matriarchy, unlike the characters in The Godfather and Goodfellas, where the men in those films, I think, are presented as being cool as well. Even our main man in this, I don't think he's ever. He's always got a hint of being out of place, even when he's at the top of the tree.
Yeah, out of his depth.
And he's like, yeah, and he wears the hat and the sunglasses, but it's not like he's wearing them. You know, it's like they're wearing him. Like, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And he never like feels like he's filling that Western costume.
There's definitely like this almost purposefully front on blocking of everyone just standing straight onto the camera. Do you know what I mean? Yep. It's like the reverse of like a Western where they're like rotating their shoulders or some kind of cooling.
And I think it's like right, button open shirts, like really 70s. And
it's like they're trying, especially one key character, trying very hard to almost take on those tropes.
Yep.
But you're right, it doesn't feel like the shirt fits kind of quite right, quite snug.
Very much so. All right, so that is Birds of Passage, which is out in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema this weekend. Now for our next film, we've been expecting him. It's John Wick 3 Parabellum. Super assassin John Wick, played by Keanu Reeves, has returned now after killing someone while staying at the neutral territory of the Hotel Continental. He's got a $14 million price on his head and is the target of an army of murderous bounty hunters. The third installment of the John Wick series continues the emphasis on physical action and stunts. This one now is punctuated by supporting turns from the likes of Angelica Houston, Halle Berry and Lawrence Fishburne. Let's delve into it. Mark, how do you feel about the John Wick verse?
Right. Well, I am a big fan of action cinema and action set pieces in general. Like, I think it's something that the medium of cinema does better than any other medium. And Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton started this tradition, and they made set pieces, these little mini stories within the film where it's like give or take, you don't know if the protagonist, they look like they're in trouble, oh no, they've made it, or they sort another problem. It's like the problem exacerbates, and that's the roller coaster you're on. And they were the masters at that. Now, more recently, it'd be Jackie Chan, and in America, like I think Spielberg and Cameron are great at this. John Wick definitely feels It is the modern, the ultra-modern.
John Wick is the Charlie Chaplin of our day.
Well, Sherlock Jr. So John Wick 2 starts with, I think, Sherlock Jr., which is inexplicably projected on the side of a skyscraper. I don't know who's watching it in that shot, but then he scoots by in his car. This one has Times Square with John Wick, and there's the general in the background. So they definitely think they're the Buster Keaton of this age. But I don't feel that they're necessarily doing it to that degree, you know? There's rather what? Than that give
You're
or take.
You're saying that in 100 years' time?
People are not going to look back.
Oh, back in my day.
I don't think just whacking it at the start means that you're equaling it. And, like, there's a lot of John Wick going through just blasting people away.
Yeah.
And
that, as Chaplin did.
Yeah. And you're not feeling that jeopardy in the same way.
Yeah.
At the beginning of this, I thought they'd actually nailed it.
Oh, man.
Sorry, never look at books.
The opening 30 minutes of this film is nuts.
Yeah.
Like, in such a good way. Like, we saw this in a packed house, the best way to see it.
Absolutely.
And had such a tremendous time. If there's a sentence that will make you see this film, it's the following. There's a scene where he's at the New York Public Library and kills a giant using only a book.
A Russian book in specific, not just any book, but an 18th century book. Yeah,
that in particular had that kind of a level of that kind of Chaplin, Buster Keaton, ultra-violent vibe. It was like an ultra-violent Jackie Chan movie. But then I felt it kind of lost its way and got back into what I didn't like about John Wick 2, which is just this massacre. And once you've seen one person get a point-blank headshot, you know, you're not getting in the packed theatre that we saw it in, there was like the ohs and the ahs, you know, that you get when you see like The Raid or something. But they dropped off, didn't they?
I think I'm going into this film for those action sequences, and I think try and see this on as big a screen and as loud as possible as you can to hear those gunshots ring out. But it's when it believes its own coolness, it's that struggle. It's the joy of the first John Wick film was it came out of nowhere. No, it was an original property, and it introduced us to hints of a world in which it was possible that a man like this could exist, that there was this currency amongst assassins of these certain gold coins that could accrue favours and things like that. And with each film, we've learned a bit more information, and I don't think that's actually helped us out in any way. Because if we are to believe that John Wick exists in this world and we are following John Wick would know about all of these things already and wouldn't need to make a big deal out of them.
There's a paradox in there.
Yeah, exactly. And so as we have to learn all the rules about... there's so many of these things, like there's a table and a high table and you're under the table and a ticket and a medallion and a binder or something or other.
Crucifixes.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Like bigger weird coins that have blood marks on them and magically can be presented to Halle Berry and she owes you a favour.
Just get rid of all of that. You could lose 30 minutes from this film, I think. But that being said, if you have to wade through all of the rules of John Wick and you still get to have the films afterwards, I'll do it again. Like I'd if I have another 30 minutes of coin transfers and things like that, fine. As long as he kills more people.
I think thinking about this film now over the course of kind of three films, you want some kind of story character development, but given the whole essential premise of just John Wick being John Wick and being, I don't want to butcher his name in Russian or whatever they call him, but being this kind of presence who is frightening to any ninja, I think this is just kind of John Wick 2.0 again in a way from John Wick 2, because absolutely, with number one you do have this story and a genuine emotion, like, come on, he killed a puppy. Well, they killed his puppy. You want vengeance for this.
Yeah.
But with this, it feels like kind of being hit over the head again with that ultra-violence, which I personally loved in John Wick 2, but then with this, it's a rinse and repeat job and feels very Call of Duty as well in a way.
It has video game quality to it.
Definitely. And I feel like in 10 years, if I haven't watched them again, I will confuse scenes from 2 and 3 time. Like, I won't know which is from which. Whereas 1, like you said, it's got that thrust through it because you're like, they killed his dog. Like, you know, you
come
want...
on.
You can taste the blood as much as him. You can smell it.
Yeah, but go and smell it. Anyway, it's fun.
It is fun.
Yeah, I can't wait to show this film to my dad. I just know he's going to love it. All right. So that is John Wick Chapter 3. do go and check that one out along with Birds of Passage. It's definitely one for fans of, well, the previous John Wick films, anyone that saw Atomic Blonde. You mentioned The Raid already, Mark. We've actually got some cameo appearances from one of the guys from The Raid. Also, anyone who's a big fan of that one scene that happens in a skyscraper in Skyfall. Because I think there's a lot of magpieing going on in this film.
Who thought that could be longer?
Yeah.
A lot longer.
Also, just I think Keanu Reeves is having a bit of a like social renaissance at the moment. Everyone's back
love
in Keanu Reeves.
Keanu.
Yeah, yeah.
Always loved Keanu.
So just like maybe take your mum who loves
who loves Keanu.
Something's Got to Give. Like, ooh. Oh, I love the nice doctor and Something's Got to Give. Oh, mum, he's got a new film out.
This is the most sadistic John Wick as well. I feel there's bits in it. I was like, wow. You know, I feel like I'm getting old. And I was just like, is that right? Should I be enjoying this? You know? Skewered someone's eye.
Well, you're allowed to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, if you don't fancy heading out to the cinema this weekend, you can also check something out on Curzon Home Cinema. Of course, Birds of Passage is on there, but there's a new collection that we've named Can Comebacks, isn't there?
Yeah, we've got some directors who have films at Cannes this year, so you can check out their previous work if you're interested. So we've got The Neon Demon by Nicholas Winding in Refn, Root Irish by Ken Loach, Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer, that's a great one that's newly available and you can get on there, a really good action film.
Yeah, let's say that one suffered some delays.
It's finally with us. Very good, very good. Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise and Aquarius.
Yeah, Kleber Mendoza-Filho's film, he followed up Neighbouring Sounds, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. Yeah. I haven't had the chance to watch Aquarius, and so now I can go back and do that. And, of course, any Dardenne fans, you got 2 Days, One Night
yes.
on there as well. So do check out that. Some lovely homework for the weekend. If you've got any thoughts on Birds of Passage, do email us. You can let us know your thoughts by tweeting at Curzon Cinemas. And we'll do a call out for a topic for next week's episode as well. Do follow us there. If it's your first time listening to the show, you can follow us on iTunes, Acast, subscribe when you're there. Do it on Spotify now as well. And leave us a review or comment, that would be absolutely wonderful. And if you haven't had enough of us, you can keep up with all of us on Twitter. For Caitlin, you are over there at...
I am, I'm at CSA Quinlan.
Mark?
Mark D. Towers.
Alasdair Bayman.
There's a D in there, isn't it?
Yes, is it Scottish, sadly?
Yeah.
Sadly?
And I'm there at Jake H. Cunningham. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.